Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. Today we take you on a musical tour, spanning genre and the state of North Carolina itself. We begin with the Grammy-winning Turtle Island String Quartet, fusing the classical quartet aesthetic with contemporary American styles. Then we'll transport you with the sounds of gypsy jazz, courtesy of Rex and Fatima Guitar Criminals. The Piedmont Triad Jazz Orchestra kicks off their second full season, and if you didn't make it to Hopscotch last weekend, or even if you did, technical producer Eddie Garcia lets you in on his own festival experience with his Hopscotch audio diary. All of this is coming up next, after the news. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. Technical producer Eddie Garcia lets you read, hear his diary from Hopscotch this past weekend. But first, David Ford talks Jelly Rags and Monk with Turtle Island String Quartet violinist David Balakrishnan. On Thursday, the String Quartet played a concert with jazz pianist Cyrus Chestnut as part of Wake Forest University's Seacrest Artist Series. The show explored jazz and classical traditions with American music, from Jelly Roll Morton to Thelonious Monk. Throughout their history together, the quartet has played with the sounds of folk, bluegrass, swing, bebop, funk, R&B. The list goes on. And their experimentation has paid off, with Grammy Awards for Best Classical Crossover Album in 2006 and 2008. While they certainly explore contemporary musical fusion, the quartet isn't afraid of reviving long-lost tradition either. Turtle Island is known for its revival of improvisational and compositional chamber traditions that haven't been explored by string musicians for nearly 200 years. Violinist David Balakrishnan co-founded the groundbreaking crossover string quartet more than 30 years ago. He spoke with executive producer David Ford in August, ahead of their performance with the jazz pianist Cyrus Chestnut in Ravinia.
You see things now that are really becoming established that players very much now want to cover a wide range of style playing these bowed string instruments. And that's the big difference. In the 80s, it was still so rare that string players would have any sense of improvisation. And for good reason, because the demands of playing the style that they were in was so extreme that it would always be hard to explore that other side. And so when you go to the dark side, as we like to say, you know, where you're getting off the page and you're trying to find, it's dark. Like, all of a sudden, there's no notes to hold on to. And it's dark, and you're, like, mucking around. And, you know, it can be very embarrassing to realize you're, you know, all that uncertainty. And then, you know, you find that there are these traditions there to catch you. And that's what, in the 80s, with Daryl Anger and me and Matt Glazer and Mark O'Connor and all these players that we were, some of, you know, all of us when we were young cats, we were in this kind of uncharted waters. And since then, 30, 40 years later, there is now such a more of a groundswell of community support all across the country for playing in other styles of music for string players. And now we're starting to see some of these young players coming up who aren't coming from the classical tradition, who aren't necessarily grounded in the classical technique, and who are incredible players. Coming at it from, you know, having a different approach. It's not that they're even that they're not playing classical music. It's just one of many styles that they're grounded in. And now that's what's changing, and it's more common, and it's really exciting to see. Of course, there's a loss as this happens. The purity and the clarity and focus on one style, it's a dream, a myth, right? Because it never was there to begin with. We just keep wanting it to be there. So we keep looking at it. That's it. That's it. That's purity over there. But if you look at classical music, of course, when it was growing, when it was being birthed, it was not pure. It was a mess. It was a big conflagration of a lot of different ideas and upsetting personalities. You know, the whole thing, you know. Not the perfect established thing. And at the same time, you know, there are people who want to keep doing just what I'm talking about they want to stay playing pure classical music. There's just nothing wrong with that too.
Yeah. Well, you early on there, you were referencing improvisation. I know that's a huge part of what you all do as performers in this group. And how has your ability, David, in that area specifically grown over the years? Could you talk a little bit about your approach to improv and maybe an overarching approach to improv that's helped you throughout that period?
Well, there's always the importance to understand that there's a methodology to it that's there. It's established, and it was long established when I was young, but it just wasn't for string players. It was more established for traditional jazz instruments such as saxophone, trumpet, piano, guitar, and that was all there when I was growing up. I just didn't have necessarily access to it the same way that the other people out of that tradition did. So what ended up happening for me, luckily for me, and a lot of people who did end up playing improvised violin, usually you'll hear a story somewhat like, especially of us guys growing up in the 60s, where, you know, we realized the music we were playing wasn't really what was happening. And you could play rock and roll on the violin because you kind of noticed that the rock guitar players were playing like a violin. I mean, you know, a guitar, when you play a note, it doesn't sustain. So what they were doing with their amplifiers was turning it up so that the note would sustain. And then if you took a violin, you could see, you could sound just like that without an amp. Get really close to what they sounded like. And so a lot of the young players were making this realization, this instrument they'd practiced to play classical music was totally capable to play rock and roll. Okay, so rock and roll is a pretty simple vocabulary for improvising. It's just basically blues, and so you just have to learn a couple licks and scales and look cool, and you're all set. And that's kind of what you start when you're a kid. But like when you start as a kid, and it's like the way the brain works. Once you start, it's really helpful to have started when I was 13 to try to play what I was listening on a record on the violin, because that's another developmental side that takes years of daily attention to it. I fell into it just because I loved it, and I had no idea that I was actually doing something of value at all. In fact, I was hoping it wasn't of value, and that that it would be thumbing the nose at the people that wanted me to be something else. But you know, it caught me, and now it's my way of being, so to speak. So as you go forward in that, I came across the whole tradition of jazz improvisation, and that opened all these doors to the way you could have a vocabulary when you're improvising, and not just kind of like making stuff out of nowhere because you're a genius and God is speaking to you, and you're just, it's not like that at all. It's just another form of music making that takes training and focus.
Playing with recording seems like that's a common thread I've heard by so many jazz players I admire. I just recommend getting out there, and in addition to the theory and the scales and the practice, just playing. And
playing with other people.
Yeah.
I mean, that's another big part of it. And hanging out and jamming. If you're a violin player like I am, it's really cool to find a guitar player. That seems to be the easiest way to go. Hmm. And a really cool style to start if you're interested in jazz is to play like Django Gypsy style, especially if you have classical training. You can get to it pretty quick. The other style to get into is fiddle music, because that's another way of playing that doesn't make you have to play in G flat major. I mean, you can play in just open string keys and flap your fingers around, and if you get kind of that feeling of the groove in your right hand, you're up and running fast.
Yeah.
Especially if you put some time into learning how to play the instrument, which, you know, playing the violin, you know, it takes a long time to just not sound like a cat screaming.
Well, so. you and you and Mark, a cellist, Mark Summer, have been with the group now for 30 plus years, but there have been a few personnel changes over the years in the viola and violin chairs. Have there been different eras in your all's evolution that corresponded with those sorts of changes?
Yeah, and it's definitely the case, and we're always going through change, and it's always been an important part of the group's history. Because, okay, if you look what a string quartet is, especially when I was coming up in the 80s, and still to this day, it's thought of in a certain way, two violins, viola and cello, playing European classical music, all written out, and the players are playing music that's written, every single note they're playing is written by somebody else, right? So the repertoire they play, the actual material they play is driven by these outside composers. And so when you have membership change in that context, of course, it will change the sound of the quartet, no question. But now let's add the fact that Turtle Island's based on each member being an improviser. So that means in the group you're playing in, you're not playing the notes that are on the page so much. You're also bringing your own notes in there. So what happens when you leave and somebody else with a different collection of notes? You can imagine it changes things pretty intensely. And yet there is a tradition to what we're doing that people come into, and you look for players who understand the reference points of the tradition, that we're trying to correlate jazz improvisation and classical music. That's the simplest way to say it. And so, you know, every player comes in not only changing the sound as from his improvising language, but also he'll say, hey, I love this kind of music. Because Turtle Island's made out of, the music we play is made out of the music we love, and that means the people playing. And as it's gone forth, in my life, I've developed a whole body of work based on this. And so I have a pretty large catalog of music that is written for this. But as I work with new players, they bring in their sound, their arrangements, their music. And I use my music as kind of a way to keep my own personal thread and then the continuity of the group's sound in terms of the compositional side. And then you got Mark. Now, Mark's been in the group from the very beginning, and he's this incredible cellist. And I'll have to tell you, this is his last season with us. He's going to be leaving the quartet.
Oh, interesting.
And that's a big change for us. And so this is a door opening into, once again, that uncertain, what's happening? And so right now, we've already have a new cellist coming in. He'll be coming in January, and so the wheel keeps turning. And so I just talked to Mark this morning. Him and I are just such good friends. We'll be lifelong friends. And he just needed to, the thing about being in a group like this is that it's, you know, the joke about string quartets, it's all the bad things of a marriage and none of the good things of a marriage. I mean, you know, it's a very tough way to make your life in terms of, it's challenging. And in the end, sometimes you need to do you just need to step out, and it's really clear for him that he needs to make that step out. So, you know, in the meantime, we're putting this program together with Cyrus Chestnut and just planning on really celebrating all these years we've played together, and I'm pretty excited about that.
Well, you make jazz and world music sound so hip in performance and through your arrangements and wonderful compositions in the context of a string quartet. I know it's not easy. How do you go about that? And maybe you could just give us a few things you've learned through the process in terms of the way you arrange for strings or your approach in performance. It does not sound the least bit stiff or staid or trying. It's organically works.
You know, one of the reasons that is because the approach to playing the instrument, I was really, really fortunate to very early in my career meet the incredible player, virtuoso crossover violinist Daryl Anger. And he was one of the other founding members of the quartet. And before Turtle Island was formed, he was playing in a group called the David Grisman Quintet. And this was like a band based on the string band tradition, but David was really into playing jazz and bringing in classical influences and just was just completely amazing group. He had this great guitarist, Tony Rice. And there was Daryl Anger, who was playing the violin in a way that just completely opened up my mind to what could be done on the instrument and in terms of the way that it could be rhythmically vital. And he was using this technique that he didn't invent, but it's called the chop. And it's this way of that now is just, you know, if he didn't invent it, he developed it to the point where it is what it is today. And it's become a technique that's used all through the culture. It's actually originally from bluegrass tradition. It's like a check, chop or a bark, and it's very common. But what Daryl did in Grisman's group, because they were playing jazz, is he started doing a lot of cross rhythm, and he developed the technique to such a high degree that I was just completely into doing that. And so I learned, it takes a lot to learn that. And once you have a technique like that as string players and you put it in a string quartet, see, the whole issue of playing jazz improvisation is that, you know, there's one, the melodic element is one thing, like, you know, horn players playing over something. But if you're in a string quartet, there's no band. So you have to, the first thing you have to deal with is how to create the sound of the jazz group or the band. And so these techniques like chop that Daryl had was so strong. And then a guy like Mark can walk bass. And that's really important too. Mark was really channeling the way of playing the cello as a great bass player. And there's no, it's one of those things like that. Why not? Why shouldn't cellists be able to do that? Well, the reason they don't is they have to play like Dvorak cello concertos. Those are much harder, you know, so they don't learn that. Well, Mark just, he knew what he wanted to do. He's a drummer playing the cello, basically. And that combination, he made a, that spot, that being able to play bass lines and then this chop thing. And then the thing that is very important to me to make this all work is it's never going to sound really right to have this imitations of drums, imitations of bass. It's coming at it from the standpoint of getting close enough, like tempered tuning on a piano. If you can get close enough to a major third, yeah, okay, I like that. So, and then you can do amazing things once you got something close enough. So having those elements together, the next thing you have to do is, and it's important to me, what makes it a string quartet and what makes Turtle Island important is knowing how to bring the 200-year-old compositional tradition to the mix. And so then how, now once you know you can do that, you don't overuse it. You go in and out of it and you bring in the sound of the four moving lines and the, and that's no small thing. Polyphony, that is a challenge in itself.
The way you flesh out this idea of, you're not trying to mimic or make it perfect. You're trying to establish like a template. And then on top of that, you're able to bring in the different elements.
What happens in the traditional setup of European music is there's the composer and the performer, and there's a big separation between the two that, of course, when it was happening, wasn't there. But just look at when it, players can't improvise, which is what's happening in the classical tradition in the traditional way now, then it's like somebody giving a speech. Then the players are their job is to speak the vision of the composer, and there's nothing wrong with that. But what Turtle Island's built on is that it's more of a true partnership. And so it's not me, like, I'm going to write my, now I'm into, I definitely have strong personality about what I want to write. Anybody that plays with me knows that. It's not like, hey, do whatever you want, man. It's an equal thing here. it's more to try to find a way that you and I as musicians can connect and you can help me bring my story out, but it's your story too. And you can change notes. You can change the, we can talk about how to change the arrangement. And then what happens is the result is not so much you're playing my piece. It's more we're playing a piece that grew together. It's coming from where I gave it a character and a theme and a stream. But it, what makes it alive is that when you're playing, it's your music. You're playing. You're feeling the way it sounds.
In that sort of partnership spirit, you're talking about the piece kind of growing together once it's there. And I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about some of the, well, just great collaborators you all have worked with. I obviously Cyrus Chestnut coming up here when you're performing here in Winston-Salem. But my wife and I heard you all perform with Paquito de Rivera at UNC in Chapel Hill. That was a few years back and really enjoyed the, I just really love the chemistry you all had on stage. And I was wondering, I mean, you've collaborated with dozens of world-class artists. What's that process like in terms of, say, the challenges and rewards for the Turtle Island members and for the visiting artists in that context when you're there and it's that intensity?
So one of the big challenges with a string player, you know, we're basically more classical. I talk a game, but I'm still probably more classical in my thinking of things. Another way to say it is I'm a bit of a control freak. So the jazz thing, they're not going to go there, you know? So like there's like Makito, man, like he's so spontaneous. It's not that he can't live in the classical scene. He can, but his way of being is so in the moment that it would just, you know, be terrifying for somebody who wants to have things to know what's going to happen from A to B.
He makes it look so easy.
Oh my God! And so we, you know, when we would record with him, he would be done from the first take, and we were just starting to get untuned. You know, our process is to do like 30 takes. You know, string quartets, we suffer. It's a suffering. And he was like, okay, done. What are we going to do now? Let's go get some beans and rice. Come on, let's go. He's like, and he was right. He was played amazing. His first take was what you want to hear. And it just is one of the things that's a big lesson for me in being careful with the whole perfection issues of music. There's this tendency to, and of course, wanting to perfect music is definitely part of the classical tradition, but really wanting to get into the nuance of how to play this music really well. And it's important, because if you don't really work on that, then the message can't get through. Because it gets caught up in the confusion of the delivery not being clear enough to make the heart point, you know. But if you get caught up to the point that you're afraid that you're going to make a mistake or it's not going to come off well, then there's this kind of held quality that jazz musicians, they're just not interested in it. And a lot, especially the older guys, they didn't come up that way at all. I mean, you hear guys, you know, and their vocabulary is so high. And they won't read a single note. And you're going, how did you do that? How does that happen? And it's been this, it's very scary, hard. Cyrus, now this is our third go around. And nonetheless, Cyrus is your typical great jazz musician. I never know what's going to happen. I try to get him on the phone and it's like trying to find Cyrus, where are you? You know, he lives life. I hope he doesn't mind me saying this. He's just a jazz. He lives life very much in the moment. So you really have to bring it, you know. And the other thing is you leave space for things to happen instead of trying to hold on to all the elements. And this is very counteractive to the way that we market ourselves and the way that we work in the world of trying to create these, you know, identifiable elements that people will know. So it's a great challenge. And we haven't played together on this program yet. We're getting together in a couple, like in the weeks before our first concert in Ravinia Jazz Festival. So, you know, there's no question that part of me, 30 years of this, and I'm no less terrified than I was in day one. I mean, it's just always terrifying to go at this thing that you can't hold, you know, and yet it just keeps on delivering. And I have faith that we'll find the groove that will hit. And it'll reveal itself. I mean, you know, the charts are already written. It's not the work's being done, okay? It's not like everybody's sitting around, let's just land there and play.
I'm not concerned at all. I'm not worried.
Yeah. it's just more you know, the hardest part is that I want more time to hang out with somebody like Cyrus, but he's too busy. So the hardest part about collaborations is that people are so busy that you just never have the time you'd like to really be together to get comfortable.
Which is a good and a bad thing. It seemed, listening to him perform this afternoon, I was doing a little YouTube skip around, I was hearing his Cyrus's romantic kind of cadenza-like intro to Polka Dots and Moonbeams.
And it came out doing
a Tiny Desk thing. And it made me think the way he was blending the classical and jazz, it seemed like a perfect fit for you all. Is that ability, is that important for you or something you seek out?
Totally important, yes. Something we didn't, you know, you find as you go that some players are more, Paquito's another example. Cyrus has just got a flavor of the, he has classical training in his background too. I mean, he's somebody who can read and he's very interested in covering a lot of ground, stylistic ground. And so, you know, I paint him as being this completely off the cuff guy. He's not. He's a very thoughtful, deep musician. It's just the way that his approach to that. Okay, so what is his approach to doing that Polka Dots and Moonbeams? It's not coming from the same place that I'm coming from. Where I'm going to come from is to more clarify in a more comprehensive, controlled way, working through a string quartet, you know, where he's more coming at it from understanding the style on a deep harmonic language level and then can breathe it, having lived in it, and then deliver from that more personal way. And it's typical for soloists. They're living in their own world they've created for themselves. They can encapsulate that and stay whole, you know. The piano can do that too. A violin can't as easily, so you have these groups, you know. You're, as a violinist, you're always in groups to pull that out. And so that's a lot of what happens, and then it is just getting integrated with Cyrus, with the quartet. The one thing that becomes very great about this is just the there's always this core connection with Mark and Cyrus. You know, the because Mark's the bass player in our quartet, and so you get Cyrus. You know, part of me knows that I'm safe. Like I'll never fall off the floor because Mark and Cyrus are always going to hold it together. So no matter how scary it may seem, those two are so connected that there'll always be something to catch me.
David Ford spoke with Turtle Island String Quartet violinist and co-founder David Balakrishnan. The String Quartet played a show titled Jelly Rags and Monk on Thursday as part of the Seacrest Artist Series. They performed with jazz pianist Cyrus Chestnut. For more information on the musicians and the Seacrest Series, visit our website at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Stay tuned because after the break, we take you back to the sounds of the 30s with the Triad's own Gypsy Jazz Guitar Duo. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. The Piedmont Triad Jazz Orchestra is tuning up for the debut of its second full season. The orchestra will be celebrating the music of North Carolina jazz greats such as John Coltrane and Thelonious Monk in their upcoming Tar Heel Swing concert. But first, Rex Griffin and Fatima Mandieta make up the Gypsy Jazz guitar duo Rex and Fatima Guitar Criminals. Rex was the leader of the Hot Club of North Carolina for 30 years. He's been playing the music of Django Reinhardt for decades and even toured with Django's son. Fatima studied guitar and piano in Mexico and brings a distinct and appealing rhythm to the duo. The two spoke with WFDD's David Ford in anticipation of their first CD release.
How about a little Gypsy Jazz 101 and Django's, we're talking about the late, great Django Reinhardt, of course, and where did it begin and how would you describe it?
Django was a Manouche gypsy. He was born around 1910 and he was uneducated, but he started playing very early. He became a great player, but the unusual thing is when he was 18 years old, there was a fire in his caravan and it almost completely destroyed his left hand, and that's why he's known as playing with two fingers. And his contribution to the jazz world is phenomenal, and also his compositions. A lot of people overlook the composition part of Django Reinhardt, which many, many songs live on today.
What did he bring to bear in his playing that had the largest impact on you, say?
For me, it's the emotion. It's the emotion he brought to his melodies and his solos. That's why they're rarely reproduced well. It's the gypsy emotion. Yeah, it's a fire, I guess.
Would Django Reinhardt have referred to this music as gypsy jazz back during his lifetime? And what exactly is that? How would you describe it?
Well, in the 30s, he would have probably referred to it as swing music because that's what it was known as at the time. It predated bebop. It was a collaboration of the rhythms to go with the jazz. It was the rhythms. They referred to it as the Manouche pump, which Manouche was the tribe he was from. And the rhythm, which Fatima does very well, kind of incorporates a snare-like sound into it, so it gives the appearance that there's a drummer behind you, but there isn't. So that distinguishes his music from most others.
I'd be remiss without asking Rex and Fatima Guitar Criminals. How did that name come up?
Well, on our very first gig, this lady came up and as I was getting up on stage and asked me, what do you guys play? And I was thinking, you know, well, we play original tunes. I said, well, we don't do requests, and we don't play anything you've ever heard before. And she looked at me and said, you know, that's just criminal. And I was thinking, after all these years, I finally made it to be a guitar criminal. So I just loved it.
That's fantastic. Fatima, you bring a very rhythmic approach to your guitar playing. How would you describe your role within the group and maybe your connection with this music?
I like to play any kind of music, and with Mr. Rex, I have learned a new style, and I just like it. And then I heard his songs, and then we got together to play in gigs, and I didn't realize that I like this kind of rhythm. So now I'm so glad to play with him, and also I did my own song, but he has the other songs, and I like every single one, the Gypsy Jazz.
Is the song that you wrote Olvidar?
Yes, it's that one.
So Fatima, the tune starts off so kind of dreamlike, and then you launch into this fast groove, and then you're shifting back and forth out of tempos there. Tell me about Olvidar.
I don't know, I just came to my mind the chords, and I wrote it down, and when I start playing the rhythm, I just feel that it needs, in the bridge, like more emotion, because at the beginning it's just a slow rhythm.
A bit rubato.
Yes, that. And then I just tell we need, on the bridge, it needs to be more fun, and I don't know, I just came out from when I was playing it, and I leave it like that.
Rex, what's it like writing, you know, new songs for an old genre in the Gypsy Jazz style? In what sorts of ways do you kind of forge new ground, maybe in one of the songs you've written for the new CD?
I get a theme, a motif, and then I build on that. It's something I picked up from listening to Jim Hall and reading Jim Hall's scripts, who was my other all-time favorite guitar player. And on the CD, you'll hear some references to Jim Hall, and not just Django. There's one called Blue Dove on there that I got from Jim Hall, which is a traditional Mexican tune. And it's a little bit of Jim Hall's arrangement, but in the solo section, it's a bit more airy or gypsy-like. And I'm kind of proud of that. I miss Jim Hall. He passed away a couple of years ago. I guess, you know, your influences is what affects your writing, and being a lifelong listener of Django and Jim Hall and a number of others, it's all in there, and hopefully there's some me in there also. And the thing I'm proud of is the people that have heard these songs that I've written seem to have an affinity for trying to remember them, and I enjoy that. If someone can leave and have one of my melodies in their head driving home, I'm thrilled.
The goal of any great composer. I was listening to Requiem for Sally and Jack earlier on, and I think of that as, first off, love the tune. It may be Django inspired with a modern twist, but some really nice solo guitar work on this tune and some funky harmonic shifts.
Well, I wrote that one in honor of a movie called Nightmare Before Christmas. A friend of mine was just a fanatic about that movie. And Jack Skellington and his ragdoll friend Sally. And being a little bit macabre, it's to represent kind of a macabre Christmas story. And that's why you hear the strange version of Jingle Bells right in the middle of it.
I wondered about that.
Now you know.
Four Fa was another, and this song sounded completely unique to my ears. I'm always looking for parallels in music, and I had trouble finding one with this tune. I heard maybe a little Return of Forever in there, but besides Django and Jim Hall, any other influences come to bear in a tune like this, or is this all Rex here?
That one does stand out as being quite different, particularly when I use the distortion on it. It's the only one that I do use any effects on. Believe it or not, it was kind of a combination of the old group Yes and Carlos Santana.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of what I was shooting for there. And hence the strangeness between the A section and the solo part.
Fatima, tell me about your musical background, and did you grow up in Mexico?
Yes, I grew up in Mexico and played different kind of music and rhythms. So I have played classic music and also rock, gypsy and tango and Mexican songs, some jazz. You know, because I'm just open to learn a little bit of everything, and so when I got the knowledge that I want, and then I'm like that. I mix everything because I'm an artist. So I do the same when I paint. I like to mix different kind of medias. So I do the same when I play my music and guitar. I don't want like to follow just one thing, one rhythm or one style. So I just like to mix and get something new.
Rex and Fatima Guitar Criminals. The Gypsy Jazz Duo is releasing their first CD this Saturday, September 19th. They'll be playing a show at Presbyterian Church of the Covenant in Greensboro. The show is 8 to 10 p.m. Tickets will be sold at the door. For more information, visit our website at wfdd.org, and once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend. After the break, Eddie takes you back to Hopscotch. The music festival took place last weekend, and Eddie was there for it all. More than 140 bands played over the course of 3 days, and almost every genre imaginable was represented. Eddie recaps it for you, coming up next on Triad Arts Weekend. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. In just a minute, technical producer Eddie Garcia shares his Hopscotch Music Festival diary. But first, the Piedmont Triad Jazz Orchestra. The group is about to kick off their second full season on September 20th. They'll play Tar Heel Swing, a concert featuring the music of North Carolina-born John Coltrane, Thelonious Monk, Max Roach, as well as original compositions by orchestra members. David Ford spoke with Piedmont Triad Jazz Orchestra co-founder Wally West.
I think the sound of the big band is something that when I first heard it, touched me in such a way because I had never heard anything like that before. I remember hearing Duke Ellington's band for the very first time on a recording, and what was typically known as a 15-piece big band all of a sudden to me sounded like a 75-piece orchestra. The writing and the arranging that was done by Duke Ellington touched me in such a way that no other big band had. Now, with that being said, I also love the traditional big band sounds of the Tommy Dorsey Band, the Glenn Miller Band, the Count Basie Band, the Stan Kenton Band, the Woody Herman Band. Each one of those bands had an exciting flair that was unique to their own persona. Each one of those has its own unique presence that hits you like a ton of bricks. The BTJO is a group of musicians that are all from North Carolina. These guys are primarily college professors, professional jazz musicians. The group is so good that we can read a chart for the first time and have it at 90%. You know, to the common person who is not a musician, that might not mean a lot, but the rehearsal time that we spend is primarily spent on nitpicking rather than laying serious groundwork. it's scary how good this band is. The talent level is off the charts. I'm hanging on for dear life. I'm glad to be in the band. My co-founder, Chad Eby, he's a genius. He put most of the band personnel together. These are all local musicians, but they play on such a high level, and it's an honor and a privilege to be in a band with such immense talent. We do this as a labor of love. It's something that is part of us. It's in our fabric of who we are as musicians, and we do it for the love of the music and for the we're passing the torch. We're mediators. We keep that sound going. We're not a non-profit organization. We're strictly grassroots. We're self-supportive. The guys that live in Charlotte, they drive up for the rehearsals. We don't pay anybody for the rehearsals. We're not even able to give up any gas money or anything. We do it because we love it, and it's for the sake of the art. So we're incredibly pleased that we get such a high level of talent in there that believes in what we do and the focus that we try to have in presenting what we have to offer to our audiences.
Triad Arts executive producer David Ford spoke with Piedmont Triad Jazz Orchestra co-founder and saxophonist Wally West. The orchestra will be kicking off their second full season with a concert on September 20th. The event is part of 17 Days, Greensboro's Arts and Culture Festival. Tar Heel Swing will feature the music of North Carolina-born Thelonious Monk and more. And now, Eddie Garcia lets you in on his hopscotch experience. Eddie attended the three-day festival last weekend in Raleigh and has this audio diary to remember it by.
I finally made it to the Hopscotch Music Festival in Raleigh. ...2015 marked the sixth year of Hopscotch, and the first year I'd get to experience this monolithic musical offering. For the uninitiated, Hopscotch is a three-day music festival taking place at venues all over downtown Raleigh, the majority of them within reasonable walking distance of each other. Over 140 bands, and that's not including all the free day party acts. Music ranges from rock to hip-hop to metal to folk to electronic to experimental, and that's painting with very broad strokes. Now, some of the bands, quite thankfully, play music that is in the cracks between these genres, or transcend labels entirely. The bill is highly curated, and yes, it does lean strongly in the music geek direction. But there are some acts inching towards mass appeal every year, too. But that's not really the point of this festival. It's a destination. It's not for passive music listeners. It's for the musically curious, the sonically adventurous, and those with comfortable shoes. But before I let you in on what bands I checked out, a brief personal history, aka why for 5 years I missed Hopscotch. In the inaugural year of Hopscotch, I was on my honeymoon. During the second year, okay, I'm not sure what happened there. Third year, my wife was pregnant and our baby's arrival was imminent. Fourth year, we were buying a house. Fifth year, couldn't afford it. See baby and home purchase from previous 2 years. After securing my three-day wristband, I raced to City Plaza to see Godspeed You Black Emperor, a group I hadn't seen in over a decade. The Canadian Collective play a wall of sound and dynamically intense brand of music that has always threatened to collapse the rafters of any club they've played in. So to see them in the open air where their sound could travel and dissolve into the ether was an interesting proposition. One that was unfortunately thwarted temporarily when a deluge of rain started, just as I had gotten settled and had my audio recorder all ready. With the majority of the crowd, I packed myself into a nearby covered area where I attempted to wait it out. Thankfully, I ran into a friend and fellow music journalist I hadn't seen in quite a while, so I had solid company in the holding zone. Godspeed You Black Emperor continued to play with some short breaks while moving their gear to different areas of the stage to avoid damage. But this being a festival, and with a heavily highlighted schedule in my back pocket, I knew I was not going to be able to wait this out any longer and would have to move on. I did find out from a friend later that they played for another 90 minutes after the initial rain, but by that time I had already been bouncing between venues. My first stop on the club portion was the Poorhouse to see the band soon. With blood on my head, soon is the newest musical venture of Stuart McLam, singer and guitarist of The Love Language. Soon seems to be a place where Stu can flex his musical muscles a bit, in comparison to The Love Language's somewhat tamer fare. Soon have all the sonic impact of a heavy fuzz rock band, but with an air of mystery, supplied by some shoegaze-inspired reverb and melodies. Stuart's a great singer, and his strong vocals is another thing that sets Soon apart from the Skullcrusher set. After a blistering version of Pink Floyd's The Nile Song, I headed off to King's Barcade for the dream pop bliss gaze of Baltimore's Wild Honey. King's held my first waiting line of the night. There were two lines, one for general wristband holders and one for VIPs, and the masses were being wrangled by a group of Hopscotch's many volunteers. After some waiting and listening to the grievances of my fellow Q-mates, I finally made it into the beyond packed venue. Wild Honey played with incredible stamina and incredible volume. They were expertly mixed. I couldn't believe I could still hear the vocal melody amongst the thundering drums and guitar attack. King's may be one of the most perfect music rooms I've ever encountered. I've never heard a bad mix there, never waited more than a few minutes for a drink, and this night was no exception. As much as I wanted to stay for the duration of Wild Honey's set, it was not to be, as the next band on my list was getting ready to start up at another venue, and it promised to be at least a 7-minute walk, and I was still getting my downtown bearings. So I had to split. And that's part of the festival, and part of why it was named Hopscotch. To get close to the full experience, you've got to keep bouncing around to different venues. But this does mean you might not get to see full band sets. But I tended to strike a balance, as it was nice to hunker down at a few venues occasionally, as many of the bills were thematically linked.
I haven't sang in days, I've been real sick, so I'm gonna pop that cherry tonight.
So I went to the Lincoln Theater on a friend's suggestion to check out the band Advaita. This would be the first band I was seeing tonight that I had never heard of before, but a quick walking listen to their Bandcamp page caught my interest, so there I went. Their music was dense, but with a scuzzy grind that recalled raw power as much as New York's no-wave scene of the early 80s. The powerhouse drumming and blistering guitar work was married with at times growling vocals, then at other times all three members sang in an off-kilter harmony. A look around the room and amongst the strangers, friends, and fellow musicians I ran into cemented the fact that this three-piece band won lots of new fans that evening in Raleigh. After a short break, which included me getting a few slices from the Pie Pusher's pizza truck so perfectly parked next door, thank you, whosever idea that was, it was time for Sandhit, a band I had been eagerly awaiting. Sandhit completely leveled the Lincoln Theater. Their songs were epic, rigidly constructed, and undeniably heavy. An instrumental three-piece equally indebted to the metal, post-rock, and shoegaze genres, they exceeded my expectations and threw down headstrong versions of the songs I had heard on their Bandcamp page. They were also the first band I had seen at Hopscotch so far that incorporated a complex light and projection show. There were black and white bars being projected on the band in various patterns and speeds, like an unholy amalgamation of an old TV set and the cover of Joy Division's Unknown Pleasures, which to say, it was a perfect fit for their pummeling dystopian soundscapes. At this point in the night, I ran into one of my first scheduling conflicts of the weekend. I had really wanted to see Jenny Havall. Her song, The Battle Is Over, is mesmerizing, and all I had read of the artistry of her live performances had me intrigued. But I knew if I tried to catch some of her set, then hoof it all the way back, I'd miss a good portion of the next band here, and I just couldn't let that happen. The headliner at the Lincoln Theater was Battles. This is the band I've been a fan and follower of for years, but had yet to see them live. I ran into my friend, visual artist John Foster, who was parked at the very front of the stage. This would be his third time seeing Battles, so I trusted that not only would he be great show company, but that he had picked out a perfect spot to experience their experimental yet infectious rhythmic symphonies. Battles played with a confidence I hadn't seen in any band in a long time. Perplexingly loose and tight all at once, they were a living, breathing, biomechanical musical force. Led on stage right by Ian Williams, he ably switched from guitar to keyboard to iPad to Ableton controller, all while foot controlling a never-ending series of loops that would be further manipulated via his radical workstation. and he was dancing and confidently smirking the entire time. On stage left, Dave Konopka alternated between bass and guitar, preferring a more analog but no less precise approach. He layered his guitars and bass tracks, incorporating an armada of guitar effects pedals. The pacemaker of the band is drummer John Stanier. His drum set was minimal, but his impact was maximal. It is truly a marvel to see this man hold this band together, amongst the insistent loops and the cacophony of live guitars. His lone cymbal, at a height of 2 cymbal stands to prevent overusage, was even more impractical and perfect in person. The crowd morphed into a sweating mass of a dance party. A dance party whipped up by the tightest and funkiest and most appealingly cartoonish experimental rock band in the known universe, Battles.
It turns out that we know another song. So.
By the time Battles wrapped up their singular encore selection, I was spent. With 2 more music-packed days ahead of me, it was time to head to Durham where some friends were letting me crash. If day 2 and 3 held a fraction of the musical excitement and discovery of day 1, I was in for a wonderfully overwhelming experience. And, as it turns out, it did. But you'll have to tune in next week for the rest of my Hopscotch Diary, where I'll talk day parties and the art of hard decision-making.
Triad Arts technical producer, Eddie Garcia. That's our show for today. Our executive director is David Ford, our technical producer is Eddie Garcia, and our contributing editor is Kike Rodriguez Pastor. You can find podcasts, archived episodes, and links to our guests, events, and more on our website at wfdd.org. Once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @TriadArtsSpeak. As always, we welcome your feedback. Send us an email at triadarts@wfu.edu. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend. For 88.5 WFDD, I'm Bethany Chaffin.